the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
And so to the week trending, Adele Coffey, the author and journalist, joins us from Galway, and Dion Fanning, journalist and co-host of the Free State podcast, is here in studio with us in Dublin. But before we talk to either of them, let's hear a little bit more of something we covered earlier in the week. Michael Healy-Rae's appearance on Radio Kerry when he was asked if he was still working with his brother Danny.
When those words were issued, that's what cost Kerry a ministry in agriculture. That is an absolute fact.
The question I'm asking you, based on what you're saying, you're upset Danny cost you the position in government. Are you continuing to work with him, or are you severing ties with him as a political organisation because of what happened? Because you can't, obviously you can't trust him based on what's happened.
The answer I'll give you to that is I'd always wish every Healy Ray that'll ever go on a ballot paper, I'll wish them every bit of good luck. I will just have to be careful and prudent that when you do a deal with somebody and when you do an agreement, you have to be able to rely on that person. They have to have backbone. They have to have the political, determination. And of course, the most important thing is that when I go before the people the next time for an election, that will people trust me? And will they rely on me? I've proven that I can work in a department. I've proven that I'm capable of being able to deliver a lot more than we ever could have in the past.
Yeah.
A lot to unpack in that interview with Gerry O'Sullivan on Radio Kerry, which I think went on for about an hour or so. You know, Dion Fanning, there's the old joke about whenever a new political party is set up, the first item on the agenda is the split. But I'm not sure anyone really saw a split coming between the Healy Rays, did they?
I don't think so, although it's interesting that it's what's been written this week has put in black and white what people would have said to you for a long time, that there's not, that they weren't particularly close. Now, there's one thing being particularly close, and there's another having a split in the organisation, which is such a political machine in Kerry, and the way they carve up the constituency is exceptional. So I don't know if it's a total surprise. I find it kind of extraordinary. Like, there's Michael Healy-Rae is a plain speaking, like his shtick is that he's a plain speaking TD, and then he's talking about Team Healy-Rae like he's sort of on some high performance podcast, like, you know, that there are learnings to be taken from this and all this kind of stuff. And it's a strange story that is kind of, I guess it's like, in some ways it's like, why is this interesting? But it is, because it is brothers. It is the Healy-Rae's are there's something fascinating about them.
They're Irish Bovril, I suppose. People either love them or hate them, don't they?
They do. And I guess, like, you know, and I think there's also that thing where like, my father was from Kerry, and he used to always say that Kerry people, he said, weren't cute. They weren't as stupid as other people used to think they were. You know, and then people would feel annoyed that they weren't, they'd actually assumed that they were stupid, and then they weren't. Like, that was it. And they said, oh, you're very cute. Is it not cute? You made a wrong assumption to begin with. And now you're embarrassed about it, and that's one of the things with the Healy-Rae's. Like, there is that kind of Yarra thing that they always talk about with Kerry football. Like, you know, it's all kind of, there's a certain line and pattern in it.
You see, but Adele, what also strikes me about this is, this interview confirmed that there had been a lot of speculation in the weeks afterwards that there was a split in the family, not just between the two brothers, but their children were at loggerheads with each other as well. And they're all very much political animals and counsellors as well. But before we even get to that, what he's saying in that interview is at odds with the speech he gave in the Dáil when he resigned, and also what he said outside Leinster House. So what are we to believe? What he said about standing up for the common man, having lost faith in the government, or what he says now, in that he was dragged overboard?
Yeah, I mean, and it is hard to know
what is actually the case without speculating wildly and possibly...
But go on anyway, do that.
But yeah, no, it seems like, you know, he did kind of side with the people and say that, you know, he couldn't support what was happening with the how the protests were being treated. But at the same time, then what's come out this week seems to be an issue with his brother Danny, with them having made a commitment to the government to support them, and with that commitment then being withdrawn despite them having given their word. And that seemed to be an issue that Michael Healy-Rae was having, saying, you know, they had come to a deal, they had given their word, and that meant a lot to him. And then, you know, if the deal was that both brothers, even though Michael Healy-Rae was the only minister, both brothers would give their support. And obviously, Danny's support wasn't there back at the time of the protests. So Michael Healy-Rae said he couldn't possibly, like he described it as being sacked on Radio Kerry when he heard what...
Yeah, but Adele, you see, Danny, he also mentioned the ballot paper, and I think this is what's interesting. I don't think Michael intends retiring for quite a many years yet, but he is getting his son, Jackie Jr., in position maybe to have a run for the Dáil as well. Yeah. And I wonder, and does he counselors. See him? Yeah, does he see him as his running mate? Or is he afraid that Danny, who's a bit older, I think he's into his 70s now, is getting his daughter ready to have the run, maybe blocking off Michael's son, Jackie?
Yeah, I mean, he's got two, Danny's got two councillor children. And I mean, all I'll say, Matt, it's got the makings of a brilliant play. A brilliant
time. If only John B. Keane was still alive to write it.
But yes, it does seem like, they're both getting older. And also, I believe Michael Healy-Rae's son lost his position when Michael Healy-Rae resigned from his...
He did. Special advisor position.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I just think the other thing, I think there's an element of this, which is just some sort of remorse on his part, because, you know, the story was that he was going to be fired because of Danny's stance. But it has now come out that no, they weren't going to. That would never have happened.
Yeah, and so he jumped too soon. He didn't speak to anybody.
Yeah, and then now he's outside. You know, he the Department of Kerry is no more.
Well, you see, this is the cute tourism, I suppose you can say, in relation to it. He put out a lengthy statement this morning in relation to Ohanaish Alumna, and about the ongoing issues, as he described it. And he said he's very concerned about the future for all of the jobs and the people there and all the rest of it, which I can fully understand. 450 people directly employed, many more directly employed. But he managed to put out a lengthy statement without once mentioning Russia or Ukraine.
Wow.
And the story here, as we know from all week, and the Irish Times and Conor Gallagher has done a lot of work in this in recent months, is that there is an enormous amount of alumina going to Russia, which it is believed is then used. It's been reformatted and put into weapons that have been used against Ukraine. And here's Michael Healy-Rae sort of addressing that, but addressing it from the point of view only of the jobs, without even mentioning what might happen to the people of Ukraine as a result of this weaponry. Dion.
Well, that's... as you say, that's the kind of statement you kind of expect from somebody like who plays that local politics game, who plays the parish bump politics game. That's not...
I don't think the West Limerick politicians, including Minister Patrick O'Donovan, have been any braver in relation to this either, are they?
No, they're not. They're not at all. And it's what's been uncovered there by Conor Gallagher is an extraordinary story. And and yet there is that reality of job, people's jobs, and no politician wants to stand up and be responsible for the loss of people's jobs. Like, yeah. That is just...
As a listener says, Ohanaish is not in Kerry, you clown. We know it's not in Kerry, but there's lots of people in North Kerry and West Limerick who Deputy Healy-Rae represents who are employed there. So that is the important issue, I think, in relation to that. Anyway, we'll move on from the Healy-Rae's. And Adele, tell me about Michelle Obama and what she's saying about Gen Z people needing to be more resilient.
Yeah, I was kind of encouraged on my kitchen sink rants to my children by Michelle Obama's statement that Gen Z workers needed to learn to sort of endure bad bosses and not expect instant career satisfaction and learn how to do something you don't like and be good at it because it builds resilience, essentially. I think everything she said, she was speaking at, she's speaking in London at their sort of South by Southwest event. And I think what's unfortunate about what she said is that it's kind of targeting Gen Z workers and it's sort of feeding into that idea that Gen Z workers or Gen Z in general are snowflakes, are lazy, or, you know, they don't want to do any hard work. They want to do just things they enjoy. When actually what she's saying, I think she's generally just applying some fairly common sense and saying, you know, you can't just leave school and expect to walk into, you know, your ideal job. None of us have done that. And you actually have to, you know, you're probably going to have to work as a barista. I worked on the deli in Centra for years, like, you know, and it's still one of my favorite jobs, dare I say. But like, you know, it's she's just saying that you have to develop these skills and you have to learn how to deal with difficult bosses. We've all done it. You have to not get the raise you wanted at the time you wanted it. And it all builds resilience, which is a really useful skill.
See, I think a lot of Gen Z people are very badly treated. And sort of like these, any of the experience I've had with Gen Z people is they're very hardworking and they're not expected things to be handed to them.
But I feel with this, like, you know, intergenerational tensions is like as old as the human race. But what has happened since COVID, especially, is that people are atomized and every generation has kind of been removed because people are working at home and there was divides kind of grew up between generations in a way that probably didn't happen before. And it's like Michelle Obama, it seems to me very judgmental. I agree with you, Matt. I think, you know, Gen Z work very hard. Like these things that people talk about, part of the deal of doing boring jobs and acquiring resilience was that there was actually a pathway to, you know, doing all the things which we're going to talk about.
Yeah, it would lead to something.
You eventually get a house and you'd be able to start a family and all these things, which people can't do anymore. So why should you do all the boring stuff for eternity, as it would seem? Like, you know, people were looking at, well, why would I do this when there is, and when you look at what's happening with AI, you look at everything, there are less and less prospects, fewer and fewer
but
prospects.
But did she actually insult Gen Z? I don't think she did say that these are terrible people or that they're lazy. I think she was just saying that we all have to.
Well, then we all have to do it. Like, not
but
why?
We all have done it, haven't we? We're just older.
Well, you still all have to do boring things.
I'm still waiting for the raise that I want, though.
But actually, is there a fair point to be said, though, that there is, for that generation, they do have reason to be fed up by looking that they
Absolutely.
Don't have the possibilities, potentials, opportunities that previous generations had, that we're in a rare state. I think normally each generation coming along has the opportunity to be better off than the generation that came before them. And this generation, the Gen Z, as it's called, don't see that because of the costs of getting accommodation, the fact that they can't get jobs, or they find now that they're going to be shut off from jobs by artificial intelligence, Adele.
I agree. And like, that's, in my mind, that is completely separate to learning how to build resilience in the workplace. I absolutely agree that Gen Z and younger are in a kind of like just a really depressing, grim sort of scenario where, you know, and this feeds into a lot of our other news stories today. There are people who can't afford to move out of their home and therefore they're starting their lives later. And therefore, you know, they're not able to have romantic relationships or they're not able to develop or have families when they want to. And, you know, then the birth rate's falling. It's a catastrophic knock-on effect. And I can't imagine what it's like to sort of grow up in that kind of environment where it feels like there's not a lot of hope and your ambitions might feel like they have to be smaller than they once were. Like the very basic things that people were allowed to hope for 40 years ago, even maybe 20 years ago, was that, you know, you got a job and the job didn't have to be high flying. It could be, you know, average wage, and you could then have a house and you could then have a family. And these were things that were sort of, you know, the sort of entry level dream stuff. Now they're kind of fantasy level stuff, aren't they?
Because, Dionne, one of the things we do have on our list to discuss is that, you know, whatever about birth and fertility rates continuing to decline as they are, you know, people are living at home into their late 20s, into their 30s. But if they do move out, they end up house sharing, and it could be in large numbers, sharing in their 20s and 30s in the way that perhaps people thought would only happen to them when they were in college.
Yeah, and again, that goes on. But like every experience has been diluted. Like college isn't the people can find it very hard to, you know, to kind of to find somewhere to live near university if they get to university to begin with, and then they have to do the have the university experience of house sharing, as you say, into their 20s or 30s, and the knock on effects of that, the attritional impact that has on, you know, psychologically in terms of never having, and we all know this from having lived with people, like that great moment of freedom when you weren't actually, you know, sharing a house with six people anymore. Like it was, you know, and it was always mutual. I don't think people didn't want to be sharing with me any longer either. But, you know, it was important. But if that goes on without any sign of an escape for people, it's very hard. So I think they're the things, like, and you see the stories around Michelle Obama and people saying about, you know, the Gen Z workforce are a nightmare and they expect, you know, all this from, and it's very harsh on people who the pact has really been severed for them. And as you say, with AI coming along, like this is all before the real consequences of AI in terms, which is just filtering through in terms of, I was talking to somebody in a big company last week who's saying, we're not hiring graduates anymore. And that's happening now. And, you know, that's the next wave of it.
Let's go to a major international story. Tell us, Adele, please, about Albania, about an island off the coast of Albania, which Donald Trump's daughter and son-in-law have decided to turn into a luxury resort.
Yeah, like if this wasn't so sort of grotesque and sad, it would be funny, because it feels like the Trumps are just becoming such cartoon villains at this stage. But basically, there have been protests in Albania over this proposed luxury resort, which is backed by Jared Kushner, who is Donald Trump's son-in-law, married to his daughter. And basically, it's a $1.6 billion complex that is going to be built along like an area along the Mediterranean's most environmentally sensitive. And apparently the bulldozers are coming in. There's fencing is up, and the protesters say there's been an absolute lack of transparency around this, the planning and the permission. So it's all a little bit suspect, but it's all these wetlands and waters that, you know, are homes to some of these really rare or endangered monk seals, and also like sheltering lots of different species, like 200 bird species, many of them endangered as well, including flamingos.
Hence, it sounds perfect for a Trump hotel, Adele.
I know. And I kind of was, you know, I was thinking a lot about our own country when I was reading this story as well.
Why? In what way?
Well, just that, you know, the defense from the Prime Minister of Albania is that, you know, it's creating jobs and they want to join the EU. And obviously there's this idea of progress involved. And, you know, if you can see that argument as well. But obviously I don't support that personally. But, you know, it's the same with when Trump comes here, and obviously a lot of people don't support him. But when you go to Mbeg, there's a strong sense of support because people have jobs there and the jobs are created by him. So it's a really divisive one. But like, obviously what's going on here is it's being investigated by their anti-corruption prosecution body now as well. And
Well, Dion, when I saw the video of Ivanka Trump, I was very taken by the way she seemed to make it out like that when herself and Jared had been exploring, that they had discovered this island, which nobody had ever seen before.
Like, what I noted, that interview was extraordinary, because what I know is like she didn't have any, there were just nameless places that she had discovered. Somewhere in the Mediterranean, we discovered this little place.
It's kind of like the early colonization, where it's just like, oh, I've come across this place, I've stuck a flag in it, so therefore it's mine.
It was incredible. And like, we're talking about like Generation Z, and like, you know, the absolute like tone deafness of this. Well, actually, tone deafness is wrong, because that would suggest that she has some interest. She would, if she knew she was saying something that was inappropriate, she would correct herself. But she doesn't care. And it was like, it was, you know,
just arrogant.
It's just an ignorant in the truest sense of the word. And that interview, just this, you know, this blissful place. We have discovered some, like Albania. These like I'd say the concept of Albania is something that she doesn't really feel any need to get her head around. And these protests, I guess, have become such a backdrop to the Trumps that they think that they will triumph over any protest, because the amount of money that is flowing in their direction, and they can then flow in another direction, will win out over any protest from people.
Adele, we've heard of doom scrolling, doom posting, doom splaining, doom spreading. What's doom spending, which I believe is another phenomenon that apparently is taking place?
Yeah, and apparently the millennials now are the worst at this, but doom spending is...
Oh, well, we've gotten away from the Gen Z anyway. We're going to bash the millennials now, is it?
But the millennials are worse, apparently. They have the highest sort of percentage of doom spending. But basically, it's used to describe spending money on luxury or frivolous things and purchases as a way of coping with the anxiety and uncertainty and all this negativity around the future, and the fact that the future is hopeless, essentially. So people, instead of saving for a mortgage or a house or a car, people are thinking, well, I'm never going to be able to afford those things anyway, so I might as well just buy this candle for 80 euros and enjoy it in my house share.
Hasn't there always been an element to this? Hasn't there always been people seeking early gratification through buying? And I mean, you could even say, to a certain extent, Dion, you know, the early days of telly shopping and the telly, people coming home after a rake of pints and using their phone to actually buy something that they saw advertised at 1 a.m. on the television. A different type of doom spending, but it's not something that's new.
No, it's not. And I guess, again, it is that sense of that there's nothing, you know, as Adele says, there's nothing else to live for, so you might as well just spend money while you can. But it does seem to be a way of actually also just putting some sort of guilt on people for spending money and doing things.
Yeah, like that accusation that the reason you can't afford a mortgage is because you spent all your money on avocados, toast and cappuccinos, which is so spurious, obviously.
Well, yeah, exactly. And this is another line of, you know, and I think, well, like there is that thing of actually sort of pathologizing everything we do. Like, so as you say, like this is now, they claim 27% of Americans doom spend to deal with stress. So like, it's like, do you change the way you feel by coming and, you know, just spending money? And should you be concerned about that? But changing the way we feel is an important part of the human condition. We can't just try and just sitting with our feelings is a very noble idea, but if we can change the way we feel sometimes, it's not the worst thing in the world.
It's a very serious story from Britain, and we're going to hear a little clip of Keir Starmer in a moment. But before we do, can you explain what the controversy is over the case of a teenager who was murdered, I think it was late last year, Henry Novak.
Last December.
So can you tell us what this case is all about and why now in June it has become so controversial in Britain?
So basically, this boy, Henry Novak, was murdered. And when the police came to the scene, there was a guy at the scene who said that Henry Novak had racially abused him. And the police sort of restrained Henry Novak instead of maybe examining his injuries or examining what had happened to him. And he died. He had been stabbed and he died. And he said he couldn't breathe. And this is a painfully familiar scene to us at this stage. But what's happened now is that it's become this kind of this very controversial argument around whether the police are so afraid of being accused of being racist that they are not able to conduct their jobs objectively. So when they came to this scene where a man was claiming that this injured man had abused him racially, their concern was not the man who was clearly injured on the ground. It was actually this racist complaint, and it seemed like they may have given that prominence.
And then, of course, Elon Musk gets involved on social media, exacerbating the claims as if he hasn't got enough to be doing in preparing SpaceX for its stock market flotation. Let's hear what Starmer said about Musk's involvement in all of this.
We need to also assert who we are as a country, because Musk, again, has been interfering in our politics in the last few days, trying to whip up division. That is not who we are in Britain. In Britain, we are reasonable, tolerant people. When we have a terrible case like Henry's case, Henry Novak, we react calmly, as his family have done.
Okay.
Well, I like this is like the case itself is harrowing, and I actually watched a good bit of the coverage of this, and I watched the video of it, and it's truly upsetting to watch that video, and then you have people like Elon Musk, Nigel Farage as well, calling for people to respond with rage to this, and the situation I think you see in Britain when something like this comes along now, and it's just a very strong example of how social media, in a way, has social media and the borderless power of social media has more of an impact on how people feel than national governments do. Like Keir Starmer is trying to state a reasonable, compassionate position, and it's drowned out by the you know, Elon Musk, Nigel Farage. You saw the protests in Southampton, and this attempt to turn it into something, turn one terrible event into something, to get a response from
ideological,
ideological, and this talk about two-tier policing, which is at the heart of the kind of the Elon Musk, Farage stuff. Now, Farage stood up in the House of Commons and was castigated from all sides. And I thought it was interesting that Kemi Badenoch, the Conservative leader, also castigated Farage, saying he's not offering any solutions. He's not doing his job. He's meant to be an MP. He's ever in the House of Commons. This is the kind of stuff he works off rather than the boring, mundane stuff of actual politics. So it is interesting. But again, that stuff doesn't have the power that the social media people do.
We have to leave it there. Dion Fanning, Adele Coffey, thank you for joining us in the Week Trending.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.